morning and welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Monday, November 15th. I'm Russ and I'm here to read the local news. There's not a whole lot today. I think there's actually more local sports than anything, but we'll begin with the weather. It says for today, Monday, times of clouds and sun, wind 4 to 8 miles per hour with a high of 58 degrees. Tonight, mainly clear with a low of 37. Then for Tuesday, mostly cloudy and warm, 71 for a high and 38 for a low, a little bit windier, 10 to 20 miles per hour. For Wednesday, becoming windier and cooler, wind 12 to 25 miles per hour, high of 48 and a low of 24. For Thursday, plenty of sun, wind a little bit more to your liking, 8 to 16 miles per hour, high of 44, low of 23. And then again for Friday, breezy with partial sunshine, winds gusting to 25 miles per hour, high of 49 and a low of 31. Sunrise this morning will be at 7:16 a.m. and sunset will be at 5:03. For tomorrow, sunrise at 7:18 and sunset at 5:02. Today's mini is written by the Journal Editorial Board, and it addresses coming NAIA football playoff teams. The mini says, congratulations to Morningside University and Northwestern College for again qualifying Sunday for the NAIA football playoffs. Morningside is the number 2 seed and Northwestern the number 4 seed in the 16-team field. Again, that was by the Journal Editorial Board, and we'll be jumping to those stories, those sports stories, at some point later in the recording. The FAQ and polling information, if that's your gig today. Yesterday's poll question was, do you have a collection of anything? Or no, that's today's question, is do you have a collection of anything? Yesterday's poll question was, do you know anyone who has ever been homeless? And 37 people voted, 43% said yes, and 57% said no. The speak out question for today is, what is your favorite Christmas ornament? And if you want to respond to that, it's at facebook.com/Sioux City Journal. The FAQ question for today was, why is the Associated Press so biased in its coverage? The Associated Press, the journal writes, is the largest wire service in the United States. It provides content for both print and broadcast outlets everywhere. Because it relies on content from its members, it's highly unlikely that one party could influence that many individual outlets to skew coverage. Most likely, you're seeing candidates and politicians vying for attention, and often the most outrageous behavior gets noticed. Remember where the news starts. Those candidates first say something. It's not always the messenger that it needs to be reined in. That was today's FAQ. Jumping to the front page, there's a Sioux City City Council meeting preview story. The headline says, $14 million projects planned on Cunningham Drive. The owner of a Sioux City commercial construction company plans to construct a self-storage facility and 5 other buildings south of Home Depot. Steve Nelson of Nelson Commercial Construction has purchased a 9.72-acre site on Cunningham Drive to construct a 3-story climate-controlled indoor self-storage facility, which will exceed 100,000 square feet, according to documents filed with the City of Sioux City. The documents state that Nelson, who is doing business as K&S LLC, also plans to build 5 2-unit single-story buildings, which will be 15,000 square feet each. The 1-story buildings will include a storefront for office space or retail and warehouse space. Nelson's total investment in the project will exceed $14 million, according to the documents. The Sioux City Council will vote Monday on a resolution that completes the process for amending the Floyd River Urban Renewal Plan, which will allow the council to consider a development and minimum assessment agreement with K&S LLC. The documents state that city staff is currently working to finalize the agreement, which would provide 75% property tax rebates to KNS on the new incremental taxes created by the value added to the property for a period of 5 years. The other front page story includes a picture of Curtis Eichmann and his father Jeff Eichmann of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers decorating a Christmas tree and hanging ornaments on a tree in front of the Sioux City Public Museum. The headline on the story says, "Beginning to feel a lot like Christmas." Sioux City prepares downtown for the holidays. Reagan Cote may be making a list and checking it twice, but she is not finding out who's been naughty or nice. Instead, the Downtown Partners executive director has been busy getting ready for the holidays. Cote said, "We planned for months, but now it's beginning to feel a lot like Christmas. It was certainly festive on Saturday when she and a group of volunteers began hanging oversized ornaments on a Christmas tree in front of the Sioux City Public Museum. Downtown Sioux City will really seem ho-ho-homey on November 22nd, which is the official start of its downtown for the holidays Christmas season. Beginning at 3 p.m., Launchpad Children's Museum on Pearl Street will waive admission fees in exchange for a donation of hand warmers, socks, or travel-sized toiletries for the warming shelter. Cote said there will be plenty of kid-friendly activities after 4 p.m. If you'd like to warm up a bit, Evolve Yoga, also on Pearl Street, will be offering hot chocolate. Chances are you'll need a hot beverage prior to the start of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Local 231's annual holiday lighted parade, starting at 6:15 p.m. on Iowa Street, before heading west to the corner of 4th and Nebraska Streets. Cote said, "Due to COVID-19 concerns, last year's lighted parade was a stationary one, with people driving past floats in cars. This year, things will finally be back to normal. Parade spectators may pick up cookies and hot chocolate at the Sioux City Convention Center, 801 4th Street, as well as hot cider and gingerbread cookies from Hardline Coffee Company, 515 4th Street. While you're at it, say hi to Jolly St. Nick at Santa's House at 501 4th Street, which is the former Thorpe & Company Jewelers. Santa will be holding court from 6 to 8 p.m. November 22nd and December 7, 9, 14, and 16. From 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. December 11th and 18, and from noon to 4 p.m. on December 12th and 19th. For the 28th year, visitors may vote for their favorite holiday tree at the annual Festival of Trees, beginning at 6 p.m. inside the Ho-Chunk Center Atrium, 600 4th Street. There will be a silent auction at 6:30 p.m. December 2nd, with the proceeds going to the Sioux City Railroad Museum. New this year will be the Holiday Storefront Decorating Contest, which will run November 22nd to December 27th. Cote said a map of participating storefronts and voting can be found at downtownsiouxcity.com. All proceeds will go to the winning storefront's nonprofit of choice. And you might get more information about hours to see Santa at downtownsiouxcity.com as well. Events like the storefront decorating competition, as well as the small business marketplace program, which will run from November 27th to December 18th, are ways to encourage shoppers to make purchases locally. Cote concludes the story by saying, "After a rough year and a half, I'm hoping people will venture out to their favorite downtown stores and restaurants. This has the potential of being a terrific holiday for all of us in Sioux City." We have a traffic accident story on page 2, the Local and Nation page. The headline says, "Woman and child die in Dickinson County crash." This is bylined at Spirit Lake. A woman and a young child suffered fatal injuries and several other people were injured in a Saturday morning crash northeast of Spirit Lake in Dickinson County. at around 11:28 a.m. Saturday, a 2008 Hyundai Accent driven by Mariah Nelson, 29, of Jackson, Minnesota, was heading eastbound on County Road A15, 120th Street, coming to an intersection with Highway 71. At the same time, a 2011 GMC Sierra driven by Alan Wenzetel, 63, of Jackson, Minnesota, was heading southbound on Highway 71. Nelson failed to stop at the stop sign, according to an Iowa State Patrol crash report, and the vehicles collided and went into the ditch southeast of the intersection. Nelson, as well as a one-year-old boy, died as a result of injuries sustained in the crash. A 5-year-old girl and a 6-year-old girl and Wenzetel and 58-year-old Teresa Chanko also sustained injuries and were taken by EMS to Lakes Regional Healthcare, according to the Iowa State Patrol. There is one more local story before I move on to Associated Press material. This is a review by Bruce Miller, and the headline says, Symphony brings the force with Tchaikovsky number. With a stage bursting with musicians, Saturday's performance of Tchaikovsky's Symphony No. 6 was one of the Sioux City Symphony Orchestra's best in 5 years. Precise and moving, it was the composer's equal opportunity work, giving every instrument in the 60-plus orchestra a chance to shine. Conductor Ryan Haskins had ample opportunity to showcase woodwinds, brass, and strings throughout. He had a chance to stand out too, and was able to make 2 flutes equal the power of a full string section. The last piece Tchaikovsky wrote, Pathétique, as Symphony No. 6 is called, was viewed as autobiographical, with nods to various aspects of his 53 years. If so, his was a full life. There were stellar moments for all the sections. The bassoons and clarinets were particularly impressive, and Haskins was in his element, getting to blend the disparate sounds into an impressive whole. Interestingly, the world premiere of Katie Agox's Horn Concerto didn't seem all that removed from other classical works. Comprised of 3 movements, it was written for guest artist James Somerville, who showed his own versatility. Considering other orchestra collaborators have created with computers dissonant sounds and percussion, it was pleasant to hear Agox's accessible nods to the masters. Written for the horn, strings, 2 clarinets, and 2 bassoons, the 18-minute piece had plenty of variety and what she called dreamlike textures. That was noticeable, but the surprise was how willing she was to test Somerville at every turn. During those rare moments when he could rest, the guest artist turned the bell of horn upward, as if collecting energy from those assembled. The clarity with which he played and the compliment he got from Holly Haddad on the clarinet helped propel him through a second movement that had echoes of Leonard Bernstein's West Side Story. The third gave his fingers keyboard-level workout. Prior to the premiere, Agox thanked the audience and the orchestra for supporting contemporary composers. She said, Tchaikovsky is great, but you can't text him if you have a question about the score. The work was satisfying for all involved. If Somerville decides to record it, he should ask the Sioux City musicians to join him. To fill out the night's bill, the musicians began with Arturo Marquez's Danzon No. 4. While it wasn't as fulsome as the other two, it provided a rhythmic start to a night that promised plenty and then delivered. Okay, on to the Associated Press. Just a little bit of a front page story headlined, Spending Bill Backed by Economic Advisor. This is byline from Washington. President Joe Biden's top economic advisor expressed confidence Sunday that the White House's $1.85 trillion domestic policy package will quickly pass the House this week, and said approval couldn't come at a more urgent time as prices of consumer goods spike. The director of the National Economic Council, Brian Dees, said inflation is high right now and it is affecting consumers in their pocketbook and also in their outlook for the economy. And then he went on to add, this more than anything will go at the cost that Americans face. It will get a vote. It will pass. The House has been moving towards approval of the massive Democrat-only backed bill, even as the measure faces bigger challenges in the Senate, where Senators Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kristen Sinema of Arizona have insisted on reducing its size. In a letter Sunday to Democratic colleagues, Majority Leader Chuck Schumer of New York said, counseled time and patience for working through a bill this size. Consumer prices have soared 6.2% over the last year, the biggest 12-month jump since 1990. Dees acknowledged that prices may not fully return to a more normal 2% level until next year due to the lingering effects of COVID-19, but he said the measure will go a long way toward lowering costs for American families. We're confident this bill, as it moves through the process, is going to be fully paid for, and not only that, it's actually going to reduce deficits over the long term. And I believe that's a quote from Schumer's letter, but it doesn't say that. Biden on Monday planned to sign a related $1 trillion infrastructure bill, a bipartisan effort that was passed earlier this month after the President and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi pledged action on Biden's broader package expanding health, child, elder care, and climate change by mid-November. There are a couple of items for your daily COVID-19 update. The first says Europe leaders blamed. Eastern countries see highest COVID-19 death rates in the world. This is byline from Belgrade, Serbia. For 2 months now, a stubborn wave of virus infections has ripped mercilessly through several countries in Central and Eastern Europe, where vaccination rates are much lower than elsewhere on the continent. While medical workers pleaded for tough restrictions or even lockdowns, leaders let the virus rage unimpeded for weeks. There's a quote here, "I don't believe in measures. I don't believe in the same measures that existed before the vaccines," Serbian Prime Minister Ana Brnabic said last month as the Balkan nation sustained some of its worst daily death tolls of the pandemic. A World Health Organization official declared earlier this month that Europe is again at the epicenter of the coronavirus pandemic. While several Western European countries are seeing spikes in infections, it is nations to the east that are driving fatalities. Romania, Bulgaria, and the Balkan states recorded some of the highest per capita death rates in the world in the first week of November, according to the WHO. Experts say fumbled vaccination campaigns and underfunded and mismanaged health systems set the stage for the latest outbreaks, which gathered pace as leaders dithered. Some are acting now, but many doctors say it took too long and is still not enough. Many governments in the region are facing elections soon, and that no doubt made them reluctant to force people to get vaccinated or impose unpopular lockdowns, even in former communist nations that once carried out mandatory inoculations without hesitation, or where leaders were quick to introduce closures earlier in the pandemic. But politicians' failure to quickly heed the calls of the medical community has likely undermined an already weak trust in institutions in countries where corruption is widespread. Misinformation about vaccines has also found fertile ground amid the broader distrust of authority. That has left countries stumbling through the latest surge with few protections. While nations around the world have struggled with resistance to vaccines, many in Central and Eastern Europe have particularly low rates for places where supply is not an issue. Bulgaria and Romania, both in the European Union, have fully vaccinated about 23% and 35% of their populations respectively, Bosnia and Herzegovina has just 21% fully vaccinated. Referring to Romania's slow response, physician and health statistician Octavian Germa described his country as a textbook example of the tragic consequences produced by a political takeover of the pandemic response. Leaders finally introduced a curfew this month, requiring people who don't have a COVID pass, which shows proof of vaccination, recovery from the illness, or a negative test, to stay at home from 10 p.m. to 5 a.m. Infections have since dropped slightly, but hospitals remain overwhelmed. Also on Sunday, the Austrian government ordered a nationwide lockdown for unvaccinated people starting at midnight to combat rising coronavirus infections and deaths. The other big coronavirus story is headlined, CDC moves away from herd immunity goal. Since the earliest days of the pandemic, there has been one collective goal for bringing it to an end, achieving herd immunity. That's when so many people are immune to a virus that it runs out of potential hosts to infect, causing an outbreak to sputter out. Many Americans embrace the novel farmyard phrase, and with it the projection that once 70% to 80% or 85% of the population was vaccinated against COVID-19, the virus would go away and the pandemic would be over. Now the herd is restless, and experts at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have set aside herd immunity as a national goal. The prospects for meeting a clear herd immunity target are very complicated, said Dr. Jefferson Jones, a medical officer on the CDC's COVID-19 Epidemiology Task Force. Jones said, thinking that we'll be able to achieve some kind of threshold where there'll be no more transmission of infections may not be possible. Vaccines have been quite effective at preventing cases of COVID-19 that lead to severe illness and death, but none has proved reliable at blocking transmission of the virus, Jones noted. Recent evidence has also made clear that the immunity provided by vaccines can wane in a matter of months. The result is that even if vaccination were universal, the coronavirus would probably continue to spread. We would discourage thinking in terms of a strict goal, Jones said. To Dr. Oliver Brooks, a member of the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, it was a sobering new message with potentially worrisome effects. With just 58.5% of all Americans fully vaccinated, we do need to increase the uptake of COVID-19 shots, said Brooks, chief medical officer of Watts Healthcare in Los Angeles. Unfortunately, he said, Jones's unexpected admission almost makes you less motivated to get more people vaccinated. Brooks said he worries that as the CDC backs off a specific target for herd immunity, it will take the air out of efforts to run up vaccination levels. And if public health officials stop talking about the herd, people may lose sight of the fact that vaccination is not just an act of personal protection, but a way to protect the community. A public tack away from the promise of herd immunity may also further undermine the CDC's credibility when it comes to fighting the coronavirus. On issues ranging from the use of masks to how the virus spreads, the agency has made some dramatic about-faces over the course of the pandemic. Those reversals were prompted by new scientific discoveries about how the novel virus behaves, but they've also provided ample fuel for COVID-19 skeptics, especially those in conservative media. Dr. John Brooks, chief medical officer for the CDC's COVID response, said it's a science communications problem. We said, based on our experience with other diseases, that when you get up to 70 to 80%, you often get herd immunity. But the SARS-CoV-2 virus didn't get the memo. And then Dr. John Brooks went on to say, it has a lot of tricks up its sleeve, and it's repeatedly challenged us. it's impossible to predict what herd immunity will be in a new pathogen until you reach herd immunity. The CDC's new approach will reflect this uncertainty. Instead of specifying a vaccination target that promises an end to the pandemic, public health officials hope to redefine success in terms of new infections and deaths, and they'll surmise that herd immunity has been achieved when both remain low for a sustained period. Brooks said, "We want clean, easy answers, and sometimes they exist, but on this one, we're still learning." Herd immunity was never as simple as many Americans made it out to be, said Kathleen Hall Jamison, director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania, and an expert on the challenges of communicating science to increasingly skeptical and often conspiracy-minded citizens. It's an idea that emerged about a century ago from the field of livestock medicine. Epidemiologists now calculate it with a standard equation, but like many tools that model a complex process with math, it makes some simplifying assumptions. For instance, it assumes an unrealistic uniformity in the behavior of individuals and groups and in the virus's ability to spread from person to person, so it doesn't reflect the diversity of population density, living arrangements, transportation patterns, and social interactions that make one community different from another. Humans are not a herd, Jamison said. Public health leaders would have been better served by framing their vaccination campaigns around the need for community immunity, she said. That would have gotten people to think in more local terms, the ones that really matter when it comes to a person's risk of infection. Changes in the coronavirus itself have also made herd immunity a moving target. The calculation that produced a herd immunity estimate of 70 to 85% rests heavily on the innate transmissibility of SARS-CoV-2, but with the emergence of new viral strains like the Alpha and Delta variants, the virus's ability to jump from person to person has escalated dramatically in the last year. In addition, herd immunity calculations presume that when people gain immunity, they remain immune for a known period of time. But it's become clear that neither vaccination nor natural infection confers lasting protection. Booster shots or a breakthrough case might, but for how long is still unknown. You are listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for November 15th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. We're about halfway through the hour. Jumping back to the Nation World page, there's a headline that says, White House to host first tribal summit since 2016. President Joe Biden will announce steps Monday to improve public safety and justice for Native Americans during the first tribal nations summit since 2016, the White House said. Leaders from more than 570 tribes in the United States are expected to join the two-day event, with nearly three dozen addressing the gathering. The summit is being held virtually due to the COVID-19 pandemic that has affected Native Americans and Alaska Natives at disproportionate rates. Biden and First Lady Jill Biden are set to speak on Monday, with Vice President Kamala Harris to follow on Tuesday. Several members of Biden's cabinet will also participate. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said the summit coincides with National Native American Heritage Month and is being hosted by the White House for the first time. The summit was not held during the previous Trump administration. Past conferences were held at the Interior Department. Biden will use the summit to announce steps to improve public safety and justice for Native Americans and to protect private lands, treaty rights, and sacred places, Psaki said. American Indians and Alaska Natives are more than twice as likely to be victims of a violent crime and at least two times more likely to be raped or sexually assaulted compared to other races, according to the Association on American Indian Affairs. Since taking office in January, Biden has taken several steps that the White House says demonstrate his commitment to tribal nations. Among them are naming Deb Haaland, a former congresswoman from New Mexico, as the first Native American to lead the Interior Department, the powerful federal agency that has wielded influence over U.S. tribes for generations. Holland is a member of the Laguna Pueblo. Biden's coronavirus relief plan included $31 billion for tribal communities, and the administration also has worked closely with tribal leaders to help make COVID-19 vaccination rates among Native Americans among the highest in the country, the White House said. Biden also recently became the first president to issue a proclamation designating October 11th as Indigenous Peoples Day. Sticking with politics, there's a headline that says Biden bill would give local news outlets a shot in the arm. President Joe Biden's $1.85 trillion social spending bill includes a provision that, if it becomes law, would mark the first time the federal government has offered targeted support in response to the decline of local news. The help would come in the form of a payroll tax credit for companies that employ eligible local journalists. The measure would allow newspapers, digital news outlets, and radio and television stations to claim a tax credit of $25,000 the first year and $15,000 the next four years, for up to 1,500 journalists. It's a response to growing alarm that the elimination of newsroom jobs is leaving communities without access to critical information. The concern has grown since a hedge fund with a reputation of ruthless cost-cutting acquired Tribune, one of the nation's largest newspaper chains, in May. Already, about one-fourth of the country's newspapers have closed, and half of the local journalism jobs have evaporated in the past 15 years, according to research from the University of North Carolina. That leaves about 1,800 communities with no local newspaper. But the credit, which would cost $1.67 billion over the next 5 years, does create some tension for the industry. Some top Republicans in Congress have derided it as a handout. Leading journalists also acknowledge that it's awkward to receive financial assistance from a government they cover independently. Still, given the sense of crisis the industry is facing, many journalists say the risk is worth it. Stephen Waldman, president and co-founder of Report for America, that's an organization that places journalists in local newsrooms, he said this is only a reluctant response to the fear of the collapse of local news and their business models. Most journalists start off with a healthy skepticism about the government getting involved and helping journalism, and that's appropriate. But, he added, the reason why this is happening now is just the severity of the crisis. Government support for media in ways direct and indirect is not new. It goes back to the earliest days of the country when Congress subsidized periodicals' postal rates. More recently, a pandemic-era small business loan program provided millions to news organizations. The provision is supported by more than a dozen House Republicans, though the second-ranking GOP leader, Representative Steve Scalise of Louisiana, called it a scam in a recent tweet. Make no mistakes, this is Biden and Dems in Congress helping pay the reporters' salaries who cover them, Scalise tweeted. The proposal's fate ultimately hinges on how Congress proceeds with the broader legislation, which has only attracted Democratic support and has become bogged down by divisions in the House and Senate. Notably, it is one of the few provisions to which House and Senate Democrats have already agreed. Lawmakers will resume debate on the bill when they return to Washington this coming week. Though the proposal's main objective was to rescue small papers that were hit hard as ad dollars evaporated at the start of the pandemic, it will help some larger companies. Should the tax break become law, Gannett, one of the nation's largest remaining newspaper chains, could gain as much as $127 million over 5 years, according to an analysis by the AP. Sticking with the Nation page, Rittenhouse trial verdict unlikely to end gun debate. Kyle Rittenhouse walked the streets of Kenosha, Wisconsin, a rifle slung around his chest and shoulder. The weapon was supposed to be for hunting on a friend's property up north, the friend said. But on that night in August 2020, Rittenhouse says he took the Smith & Wesson AR-style semi-automatic with him as he volunteered to protect property damage during protests the previous evening. Before midnight, he used it to shoot three people, killing two. After a roughly two-week trial, a jury will soon deliberate whether Rittenhouse is guilty of charges including murder that could send him to prison for life. Was the then 17-year-old forced to act in self-defense while trying to deter crime, as he and his defense attorneys say? Or did Rittenhouse, the only person in a well-armed crowd to shoot anyone, provoke people with his weapon, instigating the bloodshed, as prosecutors argue? It's a similar debate to what has played out across the country around the use of guns, particularly at protests like the one in Kenosha over the shooting of Jacob Blake by a white police officer, or in other cities over pandemic-related restrictions. In Rittenhouse, some see a patriot defending an American city from destruction when police were unwilling or too overwhelmed to do so. Others see an irresponsible kid in over his head, enamored with the brandishing a firearm, or someone looking for trouble or people to shoot. On the streets of Kenosha that night, Rittenhouse was notable to some for his apparent youthfulness, but for a while anyway, he was just another person with a gun. The Kenosha protest was one of many that year to draw armed militias or counter-protesters. Protesters, too, were armed. Kenosha police officer Pep Moretta and others have testified. "We were surrounded all night," Moretta said, adding, "There was probably more people armed with weapons than not." The shooting occurred as the coronavirus pandemic raged in the United States and 3 months after the killing of George Floyd, a black man, by a white police officer in Minneapolis, prompted protests, some violent, in cities big and small. The election between President Donald Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden was heating up, with an increase in homicides and calls to defund the police. All of those factors, experts say, led to a historic spike in the number of background checks to buy or possess a firearm, a key barometer of gun sales. In 2020, the FBI's National Instant Criminal Background Check System database reported almost 39.7 million background checks for gun purchases, more than double the 14.4 million in 2010. Rittenhouse wasn't old enough to buy a firearm, but in May 2020, he gave money to his sister's boyfriend, Dominic Black, with whom he had gone shooting in northern Wisconsin, and Black bought the Smith & Wesson for him. The gun was supposed to remain in a safe at the home of Black's stepfather, Black testified. Then on August 23rd, a white Kenosha police officer responding to a domestic disturbance call shot Blake, who investigators said was armed with a knife. The shooting sparked the protests where people damaged buildings and started fires, at one point burning over 100 vehicles in the lot of a car dealership. Black said that was when his stepfather got the guns out of his safe in the garage and brought them into the house. On August 25th, Rittenhouse traveled to Kenosha from his home in Illinois. He and Black helped clean up businesses damaged in the unrest, then went to Black's house. When they left again for the scene of the protests, they both took their guns. Richie McGinnis, the chief video director for the Daily Caller, a conservative news site, arrived in Kenosha after working at other protests around the country. "This protest was different because Wisconsin law allows some people to openly carry weapons," and he testified that as he followed Rittenhouse through the night, he sensed something bad could happen. Ryan Balch said he carried an AR-style rifle that night and wore body armor to protect himself from protesters who were armed. The former Army infantryman said he patrolled streets with Rittenhouse, who told Balch he was 19 and an EMT and thought he seemed like a young and impressionable kid and a little under-equipped and under-experienced. Gage Grosskreutz, a protester and volunteer medic, carried a loaded pistol. A supporter of the Second Amendment right to bear arms, he said it was the same as any other day. It's keys, phone, wallet, gun. Grosskreutz became the third person shot by Rittenhouse that night. He testified that he drew his weapon because he believed Rittenhouse, who had already fatally shot Joseph Rosenbaum and Anthony Huber, was an active shooter. He said Rittenhouse shot him in the arm right after Grosskreutz unintentionally pointed his pistol toward the 17-year-old. I'm going to jump now to sports. It looks like it was a pretty big weekend. The first story is for college football, NAIA football. And the headline says, Sweet Home Cooking. Morningside and Northwestern earn first-round home games. Not only did the Morningside University and Northwestern college football teams make it into the NAIA football championship series on Sunday, both the Red Raiders and Mustangs earned top four seeds. The Mustangs earned the number two overall seed, while the Red Raiders were given the fourth seed of the first round of the tournament, which starts Saturday on campus sites. It also just so happens that the Mustangs and Red Raiders will play at home at noon Saturday. The Mustangs went through the GPAC season with a 10-0 slate and needed a road win at Northwestern to claim the conference title. Morningside closed the regular season on Saturday with a 52-7 win against Dakota Wesleyan. Morningside will host Ottawa, Arizona, at Elwood Olsen Stadium. Ottawa was 8-1 on the season, with its lone loss coming against number 18 Langston in late October. The Spirit have won the last two games against Wayland Baptist. The Mustangs and Spirit were slated to open the 2020 season, but the pandemic took that opportunity away. Ottawa started its program in 2018, and Morningside will be the Spirit's 16th team in program history. Ottawa has played a GPAC team. The Spirit beat Doan in 2019. Northwestern, meanwhile, will host Central Methodist. CMU is based out of Fayette, Missouri, about a half hour northwest of Columbia. The Eagles finished the season with a 9-2 record and a perfect 5-0 record in Heart of America Athletic Conference play. CMU picked up its first Heart South Division title for the first time since 1975 and earned its first trip to the NAI Football Championship Series for the first time in school history. There's lots of firsts in that paragraph. The Eagles opened the season with a loss to Grandview, which earned the number three seed in the tournament. Then CMU won three straight games against Peru State, Clark, and Graceland. Culver Stockton then handed CMU its second loss in week five, and the Eagles have since won six straight games. In hockey action, there's a headline that says, Tracy answers the call. Muskies goalie posts second shutout. Alex Tracy got his number called before Saturday night's game against the Fargo Force. The Sioux City Musketeers goalie wasn't necessarily anticipating that, given coach Luke Strand hadn't used the same goalie in back-to-back games. Tracy boldly answered the call in a 3-0 Musketeers win over the Fargo Force, their eighth of the season, at the Tyson Events Center. Strand said, Tracy was outstanding and those types of games aren't easy to play. When the balance of pressure is at one end and he gets some big opportunities, he stood tall, he earned this. Last weekend against Omaha, Tracy didn't allow a goal in regulation. Strand thought perhaps he should have given Tracy the start in last Sunday's game, which the Musketeers lost to the Lancers. And then Strand said, I think maybe a week ago he deserved the same opportunity, and I didn't do it because we had a rotation going. We have two great goalies, and they're both seeing the puck well right now. Tracy recorded his second shutout of the weekend, as he also denied the Force a goal during Friday's win by the same score. Tracy stopped all 20 shots that the Force sent toward the net, but he wasn't willing to take the credit. He humbly gave the love to the defensemen and forwards as they kept the Force from coming into the inside zones. The Musketeers kept the Force on the outside, making the angles of their shots tougher. Tracy said, I mean, I really can't take any of the credit. The guys played so well in front of me, they limited their chances. I didn't think it was possible they could outdo themselves after Friday night. but they did. As a goalie, that's all you can ask for. When your defensemen and your forwards are playing that hard, that just motivates me to play that much harder. Tracy has matured so far in the season, according to Strand. He has had 9 shutout periods so far this season, 6 coming this weekend. That maturity comes from the preparation and physical endurance Tracy has built since the beginning of the season. Strand said, "Our guys love playing in front of him. I think he's really prepared. He practices hard. He takes it one puck at a time. He does the thing that everyone says. He's not too small, not the way he competes. He's a guy who wants to compete this year." When the Musketeers drafted Tracy before last season, he had a 1.1 goals against average in the North American Hockey League. Strand still saw something that he could tap into. Then Tracy came on to the Musketeers, and again he was in a rotation with Akira Schmid. Schmid and Tracy were in a rotation for a good chunk of the season until Schmid earned the position until about mid-February. When Schmid became the primary goalie, that allowed Tracy to take a step back and learn from a goalie who is already in the American Hockey League, one step away from making the New Jersey Devils roster. Schmid has played 3 games with the Utica Comets. He's 3-0 with 81 saves. His last start came last Saturday night at home against Toronto, where Schmid allowed 2 goals. Tracy noticed how calm Schmid was. Schmid never thought one step ahead. He simply slowed down the action one puck at a time. It worked for Schmid, and Tracy thought it would work for himself as well. Tracy said, "Last year, toward the beginning of the year, I thought I was all over the place. I let pucks go through me, inside my body. Watching how poised Akira was in the net, I took that into my game. It's paid dividends." The 3 Musketeers who scored with were Ben Steves and Sam Decutt in the second period. Rolfs Bergmanis added the insurance goal in the 3rd period. The Musketeers also wore special jerseys on military night, wearing red, white, and blue themed jerseys that the team auctioned off after the game. The Musketeers are back home Wednesday, November 24th against Fargo. In a story about Sioux City Metro, the Sioux City Metros, the headline says, "Solma scores 4 goals." Bishop Heelan High School sophomore Nathan Solma scored 4 goals for the Sioux City Metros hockey team on Sunday, leading them to an 8-0 win over the Quad City Blues at IBP Ice Center. Solma scored in each of the 3 periods. Solma's first goal came at the 3-minute and 30-second mark of the 1st period, and that gave the Metros a 1-0 lead. Even though the Metros won all 3 games this weekend, Sunday was the only instance where the Metros scored first. Brendan Lynch had the assist on Solma's first goal. A little over 3 minutes later, Solma scored his 2nd goal of the morning, and that was a shorthanded goal that came unassisted. Colin Andre and Chase Mann also scored during the 1st period. Mann assisted Solma's 3rd goal, which came at the 13:33 mark of the 2nd period. Mann also assisted on Lynch's goal that happened during the 2nd. Solma completed his quartet of goals late in the 3rd period, and that was when the Metros were shorthanded. Cash Frigge had the assist there. Grant Harder scored the Metros' final goal at the 15:55 mark. Max Barker had the assist. The Blues put 22 shots on Metros' goalie Lachlan Jackson, and he had 22 saves. We can do a couple of basketball stories. One here says Drake downs the Coyotes. This is men's college basketball. Drake's depth and high-octane offense proved difficult to handle as the Bulldogs handed the Coyotes a 99-50 loss inside the Knapp Center on Sunday afternoon. The Knapp Center is on Drake's campus. The Bulldogs, 2-0, were picked as the Missouri Valley preseason favorite and are receiving votes in the AP Top 25. Drake reached the NCAA tournament's 2nd round in 2021. The Coyotes dropped to 1-1 on the season. Xavier Fuller and Cruz Parrot Hunt were the lone Coyotes to reach double digits on Sunday. Fuller finished with 11 points and Parrot Hunt had 10. Drake put 4 players in double figures and 10 of 11 players scored 5 or more points. USD led 14-10 8 minutes into the game, but foul trouble sent the Bulldogs to the free throw line 21 times in the first half and limited Parrot Hunt and Tassos Kamateros to 10 minutes or less. Drake held a 40-24 edge at the half and continued to pull away in the second half. I think it's time to move to Dear Abby. The headlines on Abby today says widowed spouses find comfort and potential in each other. Dear Abby, a lady friend of mine I've known for more than 20 years, and I recently lost our spouses to COVID in the same hospital, 4 rooms apart from each other. During the 2.5 weeks that our spouses were in the hospital, we visited, prayed for, and offered comfort to each other as well as after their passing. Throughout the years, we had always had a slight attraction to each other, and we realized that it's still there. We know each other's flaws as well as good points. Keep in mind, we were very much in love with our spouses, and we are able to openly talk about them as well as grieve for them. We also find a great sense of comfort in each other's company, but over time our physical attraction has grown. I'm 64 and she's 57, and we're both experienced in the game of life. My question is, it's been only 2 months since our spouses died, so would it be wrong for us to start seeing each other on a romantic basis, or is this too soon? Also, there's the question of being judged by others. Signed, new widower in Florida. And Abby responds, Dear new widower, please allow me to offer my sympathy for your loss. You and this lady are not strangers. You are adults who have known each other for a long time. If the two of you have feelings for each other, there is nothing stopping you from exploring your relationship to see where it leads. Understand that this is a process that will take more time and should not be rushed. Please don't allow your lives or your decisions to be ruled by what others might think. And the second letter begins, Dear Abby, a couple we occasionally double date with likes to meet for dinner. Usually we both throw out a few suggestions, see what sounds good, and go from there. Recently, though, my friend chooses the same restaurant and then announces they want to buy us dinner. The problem is we don't care for that restaurant as they only serve one type of food, soup. I think it's her way of controlling the cost of the meal. I have no problem with finding other, less expensive places to go that offer options so we can all be satisfied. When I suggest something different, she goes blank and can't think of anything, and I can tell she doesn't like my suggestions. I also do not want them to buy our dinner because, again, I know finances are tight. My husband and I order appetizers for the table and we ask for them to be placed on our bill, and that seems to be okay. How do we continue to double date and not have the selection process create tension that spoils our night out? Signed, Not Appetizing in the West. And Abby responds, Dear Not Appetizing, you can accomplish that by speaking up. Be honest with your friend. Tell her you don't mind having dinner at the soup place once in a while, but you would prefer to go to a place that offers more variety. And while you are at it, tell her that although they are generous in wanting to pay for your meals, you and your husband prefer to either split the check 50-50 or alternate picking up the tab. All right, jump back to the weather just for a moment. Today, Monday, November 15th, times of clouds and sun, 58 degrees for a high, and for tonight, mainly clear, a low of 37. And then for Tuesday, mostly cloudy and warm, high of 71 and a low of 38. And then the wind picks up on Wednesday, becoming windier and cooler, high of 48 and a low of 24. For Thursday, plenty of sun, high of 44 and a low of 23. And then for Friday, a high of 49 and a low of 31. And that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Monday, November 15th. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thank you for listening.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. You may remember the film Close Encounters of the Third Kind, when Richard Dreyfuss fills his living room with dirt and garbage to sculpt a replica of Devil's Tower. Later in the movie, the tower becomes the landing platform for alien spaceships. But it had otherworldly connections centuries before that. Many Plains Indian tribes gave the tower mystical significance. Most of their stories revolve around children being chased by a giant bear. They climb atop a rock, and to save the children, the gods make the rock rise from the prairie. The angry bear scratches its claws on the tower, creating its signature fluted sides. This legend gave rise to the Crow, Arapaho, and Cheyenne name for the tower, Bear Lodge. Geologists tell a different story. The tower began as a shaft of hot magma that formed in sedimentary layers near the surface. The magma slowly cooled underground around 40 million years ago, forming the columns on its outer surface. Eventually, the sediments around it eroded away, exposing the tower, which rises more than 800 feet above the plains. Today, the tower's long cracks and columns make it one of the world's foremost rock climbing sites, except during the month of June, when climbers respect Native American traditions and leave the tower to their ceremonies. One October long ago, I tried climbing it myself. We got within 100 feet of the top before snow turned us back. Perhaps a sacred bear didn't want us in his lodge that day. I'm Scott Tinker, climbing to new heights with you.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.